Good evening, Larry. How are you tonight?
Doing great, Andy. How's things going in the Peach State?
Oh, they are hot. Actually, I guess it wasn't too bad today, but a lot of driving and all is well.
A lot of driving. Are you permitted to circumnavigate the state?
I'm permitted to circumnavigate the globe as long as I am within the confines of the state.
I see. All right. Well, it is a beautiful day in the land of enchantment today. Not a cloud in the sky, and it is lovely
I would expect
temperature.
that your clouds are rare.
That would be true. We do have a lot of sunshiny days here.
And 30% humidity or less year round.
It gets quite a bit lower than 30%. It gets down sometimes in the single digits.
Good grief. You walk outside and you shrivel up. You look like a dead person just from walking outside.
It's But that's why they're evaporative cooling
Was
works
just going
so
to ask
well
you
here.
about the swamp coolers.
You can't say that. There's people out there who've never heard that term.
Probably not. That's the only term I know of them as.
Evaporative is the official term.
And so they just kind of pump, kind of they humidify the air to help cool you off.
Well, the movement of the air with the addition of the humidity to the dry air, it makes one feel cooler.
Fair.
It's like a humid cold makes you feel. If you're in a temperature when it's 31 degrees and humid, and 31 degrees and dry, you'll feel quite a bit colder at 31 and humid.
Same thing in the other direction. If it's 110, if you're in Vegas and it's 110 and 10% humidity versus being in New Orleans at 95 and 100% humidity, you are miserable in New Orleans.
It does seem to work that way in reverse, yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the weather update. And the show is supported by our patrons. And I especially want to thank, we had two people recently that upgraded their level of support. And that is just amazing that they find that much value and wanted to increase their contribution level. And again, this isn't about the money, but there's time that goes in. I think Larry and I are probably, I don't know, making a dollar an hour for the effort that we're putting in here. You guys are getting a hell of a strong value for being with us. And
Well,
so Mike and Justin increased their level of support. And Larry,
I'm just thankful. I'm just so thankful that people value the yapping that we do
yeah.
because we do take it seriously, but to be honored with a doubling of the support from someone that's really quite an honor to say that we appreciate that much. So thank you.
And what do people get as a gift from us if they become a patron at a $5, just a modest $5 level per month?
They get a beautiful, beautiful blue ball.
Oh my God. They get blue balls?
They get blue balls. Now, how can they get duplicate blue balls? They get a blue ball, but how do they get multiple blue balls?
You know, if you support us again for a second month, and you ask me for it, I'll send you one.
So you have blue balls available.
And I will send you blue balls in the mail.
Well, they're good to have to hand out to people can find the podcast. It's an advertising.
I think I talked about it when we recorded that I ran into a guy who claimed that he wasn't allowed to access the internet, and I happened to have one in the car. And he's like, "Hey, can I write down your information?" I was like, "You know, let me give you one better." And I handed him a blue ball and I said, "Take this to treatment class and it'll give you something to help release it." 'Cause he's been in class for 2 years with no end in sight. And I was like, "Good grief, man."
That's not uncommon. You can
I
stay in there
know.
for 10, 15, 20 years.
I know. It just seems that you want to talk about a witch hunt since somebody keeps talking about this political witch hunt that he's under. That is a witch hunt.
It's the treatment industrial
Good
complex.
grief.
And for those who are not familiar with the term, President Eisenhower, in his parting address to the nation, warned the United States of a emerging military industrial complex. And
Fair.
President Eisenhower served through January 20th, 1961 for
Good grief,
the eight
man.
years preceding that. So it's been a while back.
And but then you can apply it to anything. The medical industrial complex, insurance, and then obviously the prison and then the sex offender industrial
Everything
complex. Of course.
becomes a complex because, as I've said, very few people want to see their jobs go away.
I would be more than happy to watch us have to shut this thing down because, hey, we've fixed all the problems. We're done.
I would be delighted, but I'm about to tell people that is not realistic because if you look at the advocacy movements, whether it be the NAACP, whether it be the women's rights or for the legalization of marijuana. They've been going full bore trying to legalize marijuana since the early 1970s, even the late 1960s. And what have we got in terms of recreational use? It's only a handful of states yet. I mean, these things take a long time. And until there's a major change in American psyche about how we treat people that have offended and made mistakes, there will always be people seeking to be harsher on those who have offended.
And
so
you,
we won't be going away anytime soon.
And as far as a cultural change in acceptance, the same-sex marriage argument, and I don't care to get into the debate on whether you're supported or not, that one seemed to change in a matter of maybe 20 years or less from like completely unaccepted to obviously constitutionally protected.
It did. Amazingly, that was a short life cycle, and it was the culmination of a lot of factors. But yes, it did happen relatively rapidly. And without going into it, part of it was because of blunders that people made opposed to it. They caused the
we talked about that
an acceleration. Yeah, they overreached in terms of what they thought they had on the courts, and they ended up miscalculating.
I don't know that we ever visited that on the show. We might want to circle back and just cover how they effed up in doing that and push the ball so hard that they ended up forcing a hand that they probably didn't want to do, and they could have just left it alone. We should probably circle back around on that one as a policy, like a case study, so to speak, of what could happen.
Well, it would be a good thing to illustrate the when you insist on getting something before the Supreme Court, what the downside. Now, as far as I'm concerned, since I'm okay with same-sex marriage, it was an upside for me. But there are a lot of people that listen to us that would see it differently. And
yes,
that's their prerogative to see it differently. They want to use the powers of government to interfere with people having the ability to choose who they spend their life with. That's a debate that I just don't think government belongs in. But then they come back and say, well, why don't you just have a man and three women? Why don't you just have a kid? I mean, they take it to the extreme.
You start moving into animals. Yeah, why can't they marry a dolphin? Yeah. Like, seriously?
Well, but because the dolphin doesn't have constitutional rights, Americans do. And the Supreme Court found that was a constitutional issue, that the Equal Protection Clause. But yeah, we should, because the overreaching on the opposition side is what ended up making what would have been a circuit precedent, a national precedent.
And it seems
and
like
that's what can happen.
And it's a good example for us that if we do try and make a bad argument, that can set precedent that impacts us for some time to come.
That is exactly right. And that's what we caution about the Supreme Court of the United States as it moves more and more to the conservative direction. And as soon as the current vacancy is filled, which I predict that there will be nothing that will stop that from happening,
yeah,
the Supreme Court is going to be more conservative than I think it's probably been in my lifetime.
Sure. And I just update, I thought they were almost supposed to be done with the confirmation hearing by the end of this week. And so he has not been confirmed, Kavanaugh?
Well, what happens is the committee has completed their public testimony. They'll continue to work behind the scenes, and they'll bring it to a vote. I think they're targeting the 20th of September. And then once the committee votes, it'll be reported to the floor of the Senate with a due confirm recommendation. And then what you're going to have, since an election is just going to be roughly 30 days out
Wow.
from the time it gets to the Senate floor, you're going to have a lot of pressure on conservative Democratic senators from conservative states like Joe Manchin and Heidi
mm-hmm. Heitkamp
and Donnelly, and you're going to see Democrats line up to support him. And he's going to probably not have an overwhelming. It'll be one of the lower margins that we've had, but he'll have considerable Democratic support.
Let me throw this at you. I've heard the statement made, and I hope I'm going to regurgitate this well enough that it makes sense, is we have a minority president, meaning, and again, I'm not trying to bring up the debate. He won by 3 million less votes than Hillary. He is the president. That's all fine. But then I guess something to be the senators, the Republican senators have been elected by a minority of people. So we
That is correct.
Can you fill in the gaps on the way that I explained that?
The gap is easy to fill. The House is allocated by population. So our 435 House members constantly roam the country every 10 years when population shifts. the makeup of the House shifts because the states with population pick up seats and the states that lost population lose seats. Your Sun Belt states have been gaining seats, and your Rust Belt states have been losing seats in the House. But that allocation doesn't happen in the Senate. It's a fixed allocation of two senators, which gives the state of Wyoming with 500,000, state of Alaska with 500,000 population, both two senators, which means that our population, where our population live, those states, California with their 38 million, Texas with their 30 million, New York with their 30 million people, get represented the same representation as Wyoming. If you actually allocated the senators, which I'm not advocating that, but if they were if they were allocated by population, then we wouldn't have the makeup we have now. But you have Wyoming with two conservative senators. You have Alaska with two conservative senators. You have all these conservative senators representing very few people, and they have equal say.
Even over on the House side with, I forgot the name of their initiative, but when they did the 2010 census, they got together with big data. It was called like Operation Red State or something like that. And even in districts where they had, or I guess in states where they have a minority number of people in their party, they were able to gerrymander, whatever word you want to use, get the election to be swayed in their direction to where they maintain a majority control in their districts, thus having a minority people voting for them, but they still win the election. Therefore, we have conservative House as well, but by a minority number of people.
There's a lot of gerrymandering. There's also voter suppression, which people on the conservative side, they tend to pretend it doesn't exist. But you suppress voters by making it more difficult to vote. The more identification requirements, the strategic location of polling places, all those things play. And then the felon disenfranchisement is largely going to be more, the minority population is going to have more felons. With combination of all the things that they do to disenfranchise people, you have districts that are equally populated, but the participation level is a lot lower because of the efforts to keep people from voting.
Right.
I don't want to get into a great debate about all that tonight, but there people who have power don't want to give it up.
Sure.
It is difficult to want to surrender your power and have a totally fair system, and those. Those that have power tend to try to create ways to hang on to it. And the conservatives are seeing the demographics are not in their favor, and they're doing everything they can to forestall what they think is inevitable of losing power.
And then just to close that out, it would be then a person that is a quote unquote true patriot, to not call in the true Scotsman's fallacy, but a true patriot would be what is in the best interest of the country, not just my party. And that seems very counter to that.
I don't think that we live in that era any longer.
It wouldn't seem.
We did in my lifetime, though. We had a lot of people who were truly above politics when it came to doing the right thing.
Yeah.
And I have commended people say it's always down on the Republicans, but I've actually commended Republicans on this program. I've commended by name. They just don't exist anymore in that party. But the civil rights progress was largely handed to us with the assistance of liberal Northeastern Republicans over the opposition of conservative Southern Democrats.
Right.
But the conservative Southern Democrats ended up no longer being in power, and they were replaced by conservative, even more conservative Republicans.
Right.
But we've had people who've done great things in the old Republican Party. But unfortunately, I just see that the polarization of extremes on the parties now. I'm disappointed that the Democratic Party, in my view, has gotten a little bit too far outside the mainstream, and I don't think they're going to win. I don't think they're going to win elections with that strategy.
They very well might.
They're going to hold their head cocked a certain way, and they're going to try it and see what happens. But I just don't believe they will succeed by being outside the mainstream.
Well, let's move on. We got a couple voicemails, three voicemails to play, one with one and one with two, and we will start with Patron Mike with this question.
Good morning, guys. This is Mike down in Florida. I had a quick question for the two of you. My charge predates the registry in Florida. I've been on it since the day it started back in 95 or 96, somewhere around 22, 23 years. And my charges were also from when I was a juvenile. Here's my question. I know in the state of Florida you can apply for relief after 25 years as long as you don't have any other charges. I don't have any new charges for anything of anything like sexual crimes or anything like that. But there was one registry violation for a change of address about 16 years ago. And my question is, I'm going to try to apply for relief soon. And in your opinion, do you guys think that this will hinder me or stop it? Or have you guys heard of cases where this has been done before? All I see is what, you know, I read on Twitter. And I'm just curious to what you guys think about it. Anyway, I'd like to hear your opinion. And I love the show. You guys do a great job, and I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Mike. So, Larry, what do you think?
Well, I love the clarity of the question. That is a question I haven't researched because I didn't hear about it till tonight. But I would be delighted, as I am, to try to get back to folks and give them more information. There's a couple things we can do, as which we can refer them to an attorney in Florida that would probably be better versed. Here's what I would say is that if it's a petition process required in Florida, if that is what's required, then petitions have to be served on someone. And if the someone happens to be, if the petition for removal has to go to the state's attorney, I think that's what they call them in Florida, if that has to be served on the state's attorney, the state's attorneys are largely elected in most of the country, and I believe in Florida. My guess would be that a state's attorney would probably look for reasons to oppose most petitions because it's politics. If you say, yes, we have no objection to this person being relieved of registration obligations, and then something happens, the microphones come rolling and rushing in to say, well, they filed a petition for removal. Mr. Madam District Attorney, state's attorney, why is it that your office acquiesced to the removal? They would prefer not to be put in that position. It's easier just to oppose than it is to get put in that position, which means that we needed more information about the process. The petition process is filed after 25 years, served on whom? What is the burden of proving? Is it the registrant has to prove that they are no longer a threat? By what standard of evidence? There's a lot we don't know here. But I would say that if we could get a little bit more information, we can contact you with some contact information and perhaps unravel this. It's unfortunate that after all these years that he's still having to deal with this. And the way they did it is because it's a civil regulatory scheme and they can impose that civil requirement on you, even though your offense occurred prior because
you have to go to the police station and get booked.
It's merely a regulatory requirement.
Feels very punitive when you go do it and all of the baggage that comes with it.
Well, yes. Yeah, well, in Florida, particularly, they can have some really horrendous requirements that befall a registrant.
I believe
they have
so.
Local requirements that can be as large as, I think, 2,500 feet, maybe in Dade County, Miami, either 20 or 2,500 feet. And then the state itself has 1,000 feet that applies to a lot of offenders, not the entire registry. I believe but they have some horrendous requirements in terms of what, but the courts have not seen. Particularly, the conservative 11th Circuit has not seen the wisdom of punishment. Florida falls in the 11th Circuit, but litigation has not been very well received in terms of getting the courts to agree that it's punishment.
Can you expand on that idea? Have there been any Packingham kind of cases that have made it up to the Florida level to look at these, the lifetime registry and those 2,500 foot restrictions, and where maybe a more liberal district has seen things and they say, yeah, that's above and beyond, but then this district sees it and they say it's not?
It's on both sides of the equation. We've had what was the Sixth Circuit decision, Doe versus Snyder. The attorney said that was a relatively conservative panel of the three judges that came to the conclusion that they did. And then we've had like in Oklahoma with the Starkey decision, which was the case that said that they found the Oklahoma registry to be punitive, the enhancements that were done to be punitive. I can say that a liberal court's going to be more receptive on registration. I can say that the conservative courts largely have not been.
Yeah.
And in terms of due process requirements, as a general rule, the liberal justices are more sensitive towards due process than conservative courts. Conservative justices tend to defer a lot to law enforcement. They believe in the goodness of law enforcement, and they believe that they deserve every benefit of the doubt. And they tend to cut a lot of slack towards state power when it comes to law enforcement. Therefore, if I'm going to have to pick a panel, I'm going to largely, on registration questions, prefer a more liberal panel. But it's no guarantee of success.
No, and I'm with you. I didn't mean to like pit the two against each other necessarily, but there are places that have had cases run up the flagpole, and their state level Supreme Court has ruled in a way that is favorable to us. And this seems like a state that is more on the cutting edge of extreme, so to speak, and they can't get any ground in any sort of relief.
Well, I don't know how comprehensive a case. That's what this attorney that I'm going to refer him to has been talking about for a couple of years, putting together a case to take through the court system in Florida. But it's tough when you have elected judges. I mean,
are they elected also?
Are not elected. Yeah, the most state level judges are, okay, more often than not, are elected, and we just don't well receive judges who tend to,
yeah,
to do things we don't like.
Judge Perskin, California.
The public wants the registry.
I think I'm gonna coin this phrase tonight. We'll call it the Persky effect.
The public wants registration. They feel better about it. And we give, in an elected representative government, we give the public what they want. I mean, people say that we don't, but we do. We give the people what they want. We give them runaway spending. No taxes to pay for the runaway spending. we give them what they want, because that's how our system is designed. It's to be responsive to the people, and the people want a registry. We've got to convince people they don't want a registry, and that's the tough sell.
That is definitely a tough sell, which would we're going to go back down the argument that we were having before we recorded about, you know, if it saves one and the statistics side of it, we're going to end up right back there. How do we convince them that we don't want it is with those kind of conversations, it would seem to me. Also, the constitutionality argument. It seems like all three of those would be what would convince the public that they don't want it, when they know that it is ineffective, that it doesn't increase safety by any statistical measure, and then also throw in the constitutionality. But they still say, F you, it makes me feel better, so it doesn't matter.
That is correct. We have emotion. There's one thing about you human beings is you're all filled with emotion. And those of us from Vulcan, we've gotten past that.
Yeah, I'm way past it.
Now we got to explain where Vulcan is, in case that show is too old that people don't relate to it.
No, look, see, you know the original Star Trek, but most everyone knows Next Generation, so they know all the Vulcans. If people don't know Vulcan, then you just need to get out of your little box. You have to know where Spock comes from. That's just there. A bit. That's too much. God, there were like 60 episodes of the first one, I think, and there are 100 or something of Next Generation, then Deep Space Nine, and then all the movies have been 10 movies or something like that. If you don't know what Vulcan is, you need help outside of this podcast.
We just lost 5,000 listeners.
I know. I threw them all under the bus, and now I'm going to back the bus up and try again. For those that didn't get hit. All right, let's move on to a question from Jeff, and we have two. So we'll play this one and then deal with it and then circle back around to the other one.
Hi, my name is Jeff, and I had a question that I think you guys could answer on your podcast. So what would happen if a person was to live in a place that is compliant with the registry, and then all of a sudden a park pop up across the street? Now, I know some states say that if you're already there, you don't have to move. However, in my state, it says if something pops up, you do have to move. Would a person have any luck if they took that to court and contested it? Like right now, I'm compliant. There's nothing around. A bunch of cornfields are around me. But what if, you know? And things to consider, my crime is a non-contact crime. I downloaded CP, and I have a 7-month-old baby that lives in this house with me. And I live in the state of Kentucky. I don't know if that helps anything, but, and I am a stay-at-home dad. My wife makes the money, and I stay at home and take care of the kids. Just things to factor into. But anyway, thanks for what you do. I love your podcast. I look forward to it every week. Take care. Goodbye.
Well, two things to start off. First of all, we heard your baby in the background, so congrats on that, and I hope she's a healthy, good girl. Second of all, and I hope I didn't lose my train of thought. I did lose my train. Oh, wait, if your stay-at-home dad and your wife earns the money, does she have any sisters? That's my question.
Now, why would you ask a question of that nature on a globally distributed podcast?
Because if I had a wife that did all of the work and I could just stay at home, then I can stay at home and play video games all day.
Well, now you're diminishing the value of what stay-at-home parents do. Have you ever tried to raise a child as a stay-at-home parent?
No, that is not. That is definitely not on my agenda either. I definitely want to send out some appreciation for a stay-at-home dad. It wouldn't be a cakewalk either. And besides, no, I'm not even going to say that. I'm not going to say that. My first cut answer before you chime in with the expert opinion would be, you're screwed. If they say you have to move, you have to move. You don't have any recourse. I had the same situation show up here. They are building two churches across the street from me. I asked my handler and she said, I'm pretty sure you're okay. You were here first. It's going to be at the state level and your local handlers to let it go or not let it go.
I would go a little beyond that. I would say that what he didn't make clear in that very clear message, and I appreciate the clarity, but one factor would be helpful to know if he's under any form of supervision.
Yeah, right.
And when I say supervision, I don't mean the registry tracking officer. I mean formal supervision as related to the crime.
Parole and probation.
Either probation or parole or anything that they call supervised release. If a person's under those conditions, there would be additional authority to tell a person to move if a disqualifying something were to locate that any of those things that could crop up that would which would be daycare. They make pocket parks and things that would potentially cause a person to be disqualified from that address. A supervising official would probably be able to have a much better chance of getting away with it. More than 10 years ago, the Kentucky Supreme Court ruled on residency restrictions not being retroactive and that people could not be removed forcibly from their home retroactively. I would say that based on that decision, if that is still good authority, if they haven't reversed themselves, and there again, I haven't researched Kentucky law, the case law, if that is still good authority, I would say that a challenge on this would be, the challenging party would be arguing, hey, you people have already said back in 2006 or 7, whatever it was, that you can't do this. And they would reaffirm their previous precedent or else they would overturn it. That's an example of what we're fearing with the addition of Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, that some precedents, including Roe versus Wade, might be in danger because a precedent is not binding if they want to change it. They can go back and revisit precedent. But I would say if there hasn't been any intervening cases where the Supreme Court of Kentucky has reversed themselves, there would be a pretty significant chance of prevailing unless the person's under supervision.
Right. And then they can just move you around like cattle and just say, hey, you can't live here anymore. You've got 30 or 60 days. Have fun.
I would say it's not quite that bad. You're on a steeper incline when you challenge it. You still have the right to go to court if they give you an order to move. The question would be which court you would get to quickly enough. If they tell you to move in my state and you don't move, they're going to use their arrest and detain powers and arrest you and take you to sit in the clink.
Right.
In Kentucky, a PO may not have arrest and detain powers. They may have to go ask a judge for a warrant to hold you in violation. And a judge looking at the request for the warrant, if they actually read those requests, they might say, well, no, I'm not going to give you a warrant to arrest him for being at a place that was complying, was compliant, and now it's not. That's crazy. I mean, there are factors in terms of how you would get the challenge. If you were challenged in a criminal court setting as a part of your case, saying, judge, they can't do this to me, restrain them, that's one way of challenging. Another way is through a civil declaratory judgment action where you go petition the civil court to say you can't do this. This statute is unconstitutional as applied to me because I was here first. So there are two different ways that a person could end up in court over this if they were under supervision. If they were not under supervision, their best, I mean, or of course, if they're not under supervision, they could also go through the criminal process. They could say, well, I ain't going nowhere, arrest me, and then you could still challenge it in a criminal proceeding. But those are not things that people like to do because the getting out of jail on a registry violation sometimes can be very difficult because of the barriers of high bonds or even we can't release a person who's required to register without they go through all these hoops. So it's a tough one. I hope it doesn't happen to him, but I hope that answer is somewhat helpful.
It also sounds like he's living out in the sticks, but it's a legit question. I mean, and I'm having it right across the street. There was just a patch of trees and wilderness, even like a coyote living across the street from me. And now all of a sudden there are two churches popping up, but at least fortunately for me, they may not have any sort of daycare or parks associated with them, so I might be able to fly under the radar even still. But my PO said that I was here first, which is kind of weird. I didn't expect her to say that.
Well, it sounds like you've got a reasonable PO.
Feels like it. And then she said, well, you can't come back. I said, oh, well, I mean, that would make sense if I left and tried to move back in. But anyway, Jeff had another question, and let's give this one a shot.
Hey, this is Jeff. I called in recently about the residency restrictions, about living around parks and all that good stuff. You guys may have covered this on your podcast before, but I'm not a longtime listener, so I haven't heard all of them yet. I'm trying to catch up, though. So people say the registry does not work, and I completely agree with the fact that the registry does not work. But I've also seen people say that it does work because people don't reoffend while they're on the registry because they're on the registry. You guys got any thoughts on that? All right, take care. Goodbye.
Right off the bat, again, thank you for the questions, and certainly go catch up, and hopefully you don't mind the audio quality that has improved over the last 30 or so episodes. But from a statistical point of view, like, how do you prove a negative? It's really, really, really hard to test a negative process. Like, how do we know it didn't happen? It didn't happen, but you don't necessarily know why it didn't happen. So it's really hard to prove a negative statement.
It is indeed. I tell people that I agree the registry statistically doesn't work, but it would be ridiculous to say that it has not prevented one crime, because I would venture a guess that someone, by being outed publicly, has been deterred because of the number of eyes that are on them that they did not offend. So I don't get into that, and I take a lot of ridicule and criticism for this. I don't care about the recidivism rate. It's irrelevant to me. I care about our precious Constitution. And if we're going to punish people after they've paid their debt to society, then I'm going to argue Constitution. And I'm going to continue to argue the Constitution, because I have long since accepted that it's a futile argument, that it doesn't save one. You're conceding to them when you go down that path that if it saves one, it's okay to violate the Constitution. If it saves 122,000, it's not okay. And all you have to do is look at our gun deaths. We could save at least one if we had additional restrictions on the weapons that are in circulation and how rapidly they fire and whose hands they fall into. We would save at least one. Well, we permit thousands upon thousands. I mean, I think we lead the world in the rate of handgun deaths and violence. And if we're not, we're in the top five of gun deaths, and we're not willing to jettison the Constitution to save one. Take their word for it. Their tactics work better. They win their argument, but not trying to make us. They just say we're entitled to our guns, any kind of gun we want, because it's in that Second Amendment, and by golly, you can't touch that thing. And that's how they win. Constitution, Constitution, Constitution. Try it. Stop the recidivism argument. It's not a winning hand. It really isn't, but people insist on doing it.
Let me throw it this way. One of the reasons that we do have the First Amendment, one of the elements of it, I should say, is that you have the right to assemble. If you are being watched, if you are conscious of all the traffic cameras and stuff, and if you think that the government is actually tracking your location, you very well might change your habits of where you go, who you're politically affiliated with, because that would then possibly make you change your way of thinking and what you're doing, therefore suppressing your First Amendment rights. It's kind of obscure, but I was like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. If you know that they're watching, then maybe you don't go support the new neo-Nazi group around the corner because it's going to end up on some public website, you know, shaming you or something like that. It could change your habits. This is the same thing. If you know that the people are watching you, maybe you change what you're going to do as far as creating another victim.
It very well could be. And arguably, if they want to require registry, which I don't support, but if they want to do it as a component of the punishment, you have different standards of what you're allowed to do when you're punishing a person. But once punishment has ceased and they've done their debt to society, reporting to a police station to be booked and to have restrictions on where one can travel and work and whom they can associate with and whom they can rent from, that is punishment. And that is the argument I will continue to make. And when you start winning your recidivism arguments, come back to me and show me your successes, and I'll quickly line up with you. But we're winning a whole lot more constitution arguments than we are recidivism. And therefore, I choose to ride the winning trains and let the people who want to argue that it's a shame, it doesn't work, but it doesn't work. It should be used when there's public policy debates about sentencing, when victims' advocates come in and say, well, these people can't be rehabilitated, so you need to lock them up, throw away the key. That's the time to make the recidivism argument. We'll say, well, actually, they can be rehabilitated, and we don't need to lock them up and throw away the key. And the recidivism rate for people who are treated is actually quite low, which means we don't need to give them a 35-year sentence that you're advocating for. That's the time to make the recidivism argument, but it's not a waiting hand with the registry.
I understand. Well, there was a comment posted out there by Guy Hamilton Smith out on Twitter, and he said, civil commitment after the Eighth Circuit applied a rational basis test to decide the constitutionality of a program that had released one person in 20 years, and SCOTUS passed on cert, essentially means it is a constitution-free zone. It's Guantanamo, but two dozen of them. I totally want you to help me unpack the statement and then also give me some thoughts.
Wow. It's two dozen Guantanamos. All righty.
It was a deep statement, and there's a lot going on there.
So, well, the issue of civil commitment continues to be a real problem. And we'll start by telling people that when we're talking civil commitment on this podcast, we're talking about sex offender specific civil commitment, which is different than what every other civil commitment that we have in this country, which as far as I know, all 50 states have civil commitment, whereby a person is committed for a variety of reasons to a mental institution. If they climb on top of a water tower and they threaten to jump, you'll always hear on the news that they were taken involuntarily to a state psychiatric or a county psychiatric hospital. They're taken there on what we have in our civil commitment repertoire, is to take people in for short periods of time to observe them and evaluate them, and to petition the court for a longer term of commitment if they continue to be a danger to themselves or others. That's not sex offender civil commitment. Sex offender civil commitment is in roughly 20 states, and the federal system has it, and they petition for civil commitment after people have been in prison. They have a weaker standard of evidence, and they petition to commit people after they've served their time. And if those of you are old enough to remember the assassination attempt of Ronald Reagan, that person was civilly committed at the end of his trial because the jury in D.C. found him not guilty by reason of insanity. which left the court no choice but to commit him to the psychiatric hospital, which he remained in for 30-some-odd years. He was committed there because he had a mental health disorder that rendered him incapable of conforming his conduct to the requirements of law. But in the sex offenders, they go ahead and send them to prison, and then they magically, after they've done their time, decide that they need help.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they commit them to a locked ward where they can languish for years and decades with very little due process in some instances for treatment and for relief or release from that confinement. It's essentially an extension of incarceration.
Right, with no end in sight.
That's with no end in sight. But people make the mistake of wanting to say civil commitment is unconstitutional. Well, since all states do something called civil commitment is not unconstitutional. What has to happen is the same thing that has to happen in the arena of sex offender registration schemes. Registration schemes in and of themselves are not unconstitutional. We register, and I could spend the rest of this podcast about things that we register that we do lawfully and constitutionally, which means that each civil commitment of sex offender scheme has to be examined on its face of the merits to see if it is constitutional. Well, this was a challenge in the state of Iowa. And the challenge was dismissed because of a recent decision out of the Eighth Circuit, which, for those of you who find this confusing, we have the United States Supreme Court, and we have 11 circuit courts around the country. We actually have 12, counting the D.C. circuit, which is a small circuit that encompasses the D.C. area. But we have 11 circuit courts of appeals, and those are the next level below the Supreme Court.
That's what I was just going to ask you. Yeah.
Yeah, we have then we have the United States district judges as our next level below that, and those are the trial courts. Well, a trial court in Minnesota had found that Minnesota's civil commitment of sex offenders was unconstitutional and issued a blistering order. And the state of Minnesota, of course, appealed because they weren't about to turn hundreds and hundreds of sex offenders loose that were under civil commitment because of, well, I'm not going to speak for why they didn't want to do it, but I suspect public opinion. I suspect that the industrial complex there of people who had jobs that would magically find themselves out of work. It would be difficult if you turn loose 350 people and you had a population of 12 to justify having those people on staff there. But whatever the reasons were, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed the trial judge, and they said that we find that this commitment process is robust enough in due process, meaning that it's not unconstitutional. And they pointed out, which I agree with, you don't ever have a right to get out of civil commitment. You have a right to due process of review to see if you are safe enough to be released. This, of course, assumes that the process that put you there to start with was robust and you had that there was an adequate burden. And that's where it breaks down, because in this sex offender arena, the standard they have to meet to commit a person civilly in all other settings is much lower. They don't have to have a mental disease or disorder. The same, they have to have a mental abnormality, which is the boilerplate language. What the hell is a mental abnormality? That's not in the DSM-5.
Okay.
So we got these people being committed
on pseudoscience.
Sometimes with very little representation because they're indigent.
Right.
And they're being put into a facility where the treatment is lacking and their review processes are very weak. And they never get out. Well, the court said, well, there is a review process.
Right.
And you don't have a right. Hinckley had no right to ever get out. He had the right to be reviewed for release, and he eventually was released, I think partially because they shut the hospital down.
But he was also like 80 years old or something like that. His mom was on her deathbed
He's not quite that old, but he's been in for a long time. I mean, he's outlived practically everybody that was involved in that.
Right.
Of course, Reagan dead. Yep. Secretary Brady's dead, and I don't know about the police officers. There were three others shot, but he's outlived everybody, and he's an old codger now.
Yeah.
He's well into his 60s, and so yes, he was eventually released, and there, I think there's still some court monitoring of him. But that's the problem with the sex offender civil commitment. But the district judge in Iowa that was looking at this case said his hands, I believe it was him, but said his hands were tied because the Eighth Circuit is binding. The Eighth Circuit is his supervising court.
Okay.
And he said, I can't do anything because our system in Iowa is more robust than the Minnesota. And the Eighth Circuit said that there was plenty of protection afforded in Minnesota. Therefore, if that one isn't unconstitutional, all I'm going to do is have myself flipped by the Eighth Circuit, because if I grant relief here, all I'm going to do is have a snarling panel turn around and flip me over because I disregarded circuit precedent. And that's what he would be doing. And of course, we expect judges to follow precedent. I mean, they are trial judges. The Eighth Circuit is their supervising, is his supervising court, and we expect them to follow precedent, don't we?
Right. And he also, if I'm not mistaken, that there were significant improvements in their hospitals that also had him sway his opinion back in supporting it.
There was. It was a 51-page opinion, and I skimmed it. Okay. I did a Larry read. Well, if people knew how much reading we do for these podcasts, but it was a 51-page order that the judge issued, so I did skim it. And he did at the court's expense, and to his credit, judge did have an expert look at the system, and the expert opined that a lot of problems had been cured in the Iowa system, and he felt that there was enough due process that it did not violate any constitution, any aspect of the Constitution. We're getting back to a public policy debate here. We have something that is constitutional. We're going to have to get over it. This is not an unconstitutional thing to civilly commit people. We're going to have to go back to our legislators in the states who have adopted this and say, look, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, we can't afford this anymore. We're taking people that they've already served 15, 20, and 30 years in prison, and we're locking them up at $132,000 per patient.
Yeah, it's expensive.
And we're doing this for what?
Right. Well, if it saves one.
Well, can we try a lesser degree of restraint? I mean, they've been locked up. If my argument is, if they needed such mental health for so long, why the hell didn't you people use the mental health system rather than prison?
Right. You could have been treating them for the previous 10 or 20 years.
Well, why is it that you magically decided they have a mental health issue after they've done their time?
Right.
You can't have it both. Well, actually, you can.
No, clearly.
They are having
yeah.
it both ways. But you shouldn't be able to have it both ways. That's the public policy argument I would be making if I were in my capital. Thankfully, we don't have that, and I don't have to make that argument. We've shot it down two or three times, and they gave up on putting forth the civil commitment of sex offenders here. But that's what I'd be arguing. Hey, I agree with you. Mental health is a great thing. Let's start doing it now. Let's do it while they're serving their time. Let's don't have them serve their time and then decide they need it.
And couldn't there be a supervised release of, you know, I'll throw, you know, electronic monitoring, computer monitoring, geo fencing things? Can't we employ technology to not spend 100 whatever grand a year and bring it down into a 5-digit number instead of a 6-digit number?
I would hope that we could, and I believe we could. With there are less restrictive means to monitor people. We do it all the time in pretrial settings, and we monitor people that are pre-release and post-release from prison. I mean, we can do this. It's a question of not wanting to.
Which goes back to us just being a bunch of assholes.
It goes back to we the people.
Yeah.
We get the government we want. I can assure you that very few telephones have rung in Minnesota or in Des Moines. What's the capital of Minnesota? I guess it's Minneapolis or St. Paul. But I bet very few phones have rung
right
at the state capitol saying, let's do away with this. It's something that the average voter, if they even know about it, they would be supportive of it, because as far as their perception is, we're keeping dangerous predators, as they would consider them, off the streets. And I'm fine with that, whatever it costs.
Right. Well, are you ready to do this next article? Are you okay with it?
Well, let's see. What is this next article? And then I will decide.
It was something that you had some trepidation about covering, and we didn't axe it in the pre. So I'm wondering if we're still going to do it before I call them out. All right. Well, this article comes from the Florida Action Committee website. And the title of the article is a little bit misleading, which is totally why we're covering it. Not to bash anybody, but this is what came up on the radar. It says the U.S. spends more on incarceration than education. And, you know, On a one-to-one basis, I guess is the way to put this. If you count a child in school and you count a person in prison, yes, we spend a truckload more on people incarcerated. However, maybe that's not completely honest in how you're calculating it. What do you think?
That was the reason why I wanted to talk about this. And I don't want to knock the Florida Action Committee. This appears to be their article.
I think so.
It doesn't have any indication it's come from another source, but it's one of those things where we get ourselves twisted up when people use slightly creative headlines and reporting. That's what this is. We have, I think, a little over 2 million state and federal prisoners, and we have 100 million K-12 students, and I don't even know that at the higher education level how many college students we have in this country. But we spend far more money on education than we will ever spend on prisons.
Yep.
And when you look at the totality of spending at the state and federal level. But what we have is when you're running a prison, very few schools have to provide the same level of service that a prison does. You're not providing, most people are just allowed to walk away from the school campus. We don't fence them in. We don't provide the bulk of their health care services, even though they're more than enough to talk about the quality of healthcare. But a school is not providing the same level of monitoring and maintenance. So schools are very expensive, but they're not as expensive as prisons. But we have a whole lot more money. This was an example of someone trying to get attention. What do they call that? Clickbait.
Absolutely.
we do spend a lot of money per inmate, and it should be curtailed, in my opinion. But to say my state spends about $10,000 on a school child K-12, and we spend about three times that on an average prisoner. We're spending in the low $30,000 per year range. So you can see that we're spending three times as much on an offender.
You know, on the chart in that article, your state isn't even listed. I'm just noticing that. Of all the other states, it appears that they're all listed. There's a chart on that article, and I was comparing some of the states, looking at which ones were the cheapest, and it goes New Jersey, New York, North Carolina, New Mexico.
Yeah, there is. I didn't even look at that chart. Yeah.
Well, here's my question to you on this, getting away from the clickbaity side of it. Why does Connecticut spend $50,000 and Alabama spend $18,000 or something like that? What is the difference in the quality of the prison?
Well, there's a whole variety of differences. The southern states are very good at being efficient on their prisons. They tend to use a lot of labor from inmates. They'll do a lot of farming. They have these huge plantations. They'll raise cattle. They do a lot of that. Connecticut would have a higher cost of salaries. They would have a lot more reentry services. They would spend more on the individual in Connecticut in terms of rehabilitation. They would have more programming. Programs cost money, and that's what people don't understand. Well, why don't the damn prisons rehabilitate? Well, a prison, depending on the philosophy of the state, it either exists to warehouse or it exists to warehouse and rehabilitate. But if you look at how budgets are laid out, you have many components of a prison budget. Of course, you have the physical plant, but you have security, and that's usually the largest component of an operating cost, particularly in the South, because they don't do a whole lot more than security. But if you also have a huge component of medical, so you have security and you have medical. And the South just doesn't spend a lot on their prisons. They don't typically pay their inmates that 10, 20, 50, 70, 80 cents, $1.20 an hour, whatever those various prison jobs pay. And that's how they keep their costs lower. Plus, like I say, the salaries that they pay their employees are lower in the South. Connecticut is a more expensive state. But it looks like on this chart, they're all over the map.
They are very much so.
It looks like there's even higher than Connecticut. New York looks like they're higher than New Jersey, which would be, that'd be explained by the high cost of doing business in those states. But yeah, there's some states that are really, really low.
How about,
what else were you about to
ask? Do you think there's a difference in the recidivism rate in those states and their cost associated?
Yeah, we did that at the first Dallas conference in 2000. Whatever year it was, I believe 14, whatever it was. I highlighted the the states that tend to take a more progressive approach towards rehabilitation to spend more money on the front side of how much lower their incarceration rates are, their recidivism rates. And I kind of poked fun of Texas because I'm a Southerner. And I said, now I just want to look at this. I mean, the states with the highest rate of incarceration, they're all over the Deep South here, Texas, Mississippi, Louisiana. And then I said, look at these states that have the low rates, of which they're like one third, one fourth of your rate of incarceration. And they're all up in the liberal Northeast. I said, now how come it is? I said, are you Southerners more inherently criminal, predisposed to commit crime? Or do those liberals have a better idea of how to deal with it to keep from having to bear the enormous expense of criminality that you have here with your high rate of incarceration? And nobody clearly answered that. But I think that we don't know the answer. The attitude in the South is to lock people up
for long periods of time.
And Texas has finally realized they can't afford it. And they've actually been de-locking quite a few people. They've been actually trying to curtail and contain themselves. Hmm. But it's a trend that's going to take a while to. The sad thing about it is only conservatives can do it. If liberals try to de-incarcerate, they throw stones at us and say we're trying to turn loose a tidal wave of crime. You have to have conservative buy-in. It's the opposite of what you think. It takes conservatives to do liberal things.
Right,
it takes
of course.
Liberals to do conservative
things. That does make sense. Oddly, it does.
So we've got to get conservative buy-in. Unfortunately, I don't know how. They don't respond very well to my appeal. When I go talk to conservatives, they're polite and they say thank you for stopping by. But I seldom win the day with them. So I tell the people, since I know that you're conservative and you break bread with these people and you know they're your kind, why don't you go talk to them? Because I'm a miserable failure.
Hmm. Yeah. So report back, you conservatives, on how well you are at getting a more liberal kind of prison policy, I suppose you could say.
Yeah, and I'm serious about that. It's kind of tongue in cheek, but I'm serious. If you consider yourself to be conservative on the political persuasion, talk to people and say, why does my state lock up so many folks? And go in with armed with statistics. Don't just pull it because I said it on the podcast. Go do a little research. Look at Google incarceration rate by state and go ask them, why is it we're incarcerating three times what this state is? Are our people more criminal here? And can we figure out a better way to do things? And what is our, and then look at your prison of your state budget, what percent you're spending on corrections, and then compare it to the states that have much lower incarceration rates and ask them, say, why is it that we're spending 10.2% of our state budget on corrections and this state is only spending 3.7% of theirs? Doesn't that free up a whole lot of money for other things if we can cut down on what we're spending on prisons and see what they tell you?
And
they tell me that we need to do it to keep the community safe.
I know. And that was so. And then it comes back to what we were just discussing. It is we the people. So the people of the South say we don't want those people on our streets. So we're going to lock them up for a long time. The people in the North have decided that they are going to make fewer things criminal and shorter sentences. And we're going to try and get the people to get out of prison and not be there. So it's just a we the people. So you have a culture of the state.
We do and all states incarcerations through the incarceration rates of incarceration went up dramatically in the 1980s. Even the states that incarcerated low rates went up dramatically, but the national average went up so much higher that they stayed low proportion to the national average. But if you could find statistics, which are probably out there because you can find everything on the internet, but if you looked at the incarceration rate by state in 1982 and compared it, you'd see the same trend. You'd see that the southern states had higher rates, but they were far lower than they are now.
Right, right.
And you'd see that the same states that had low rates then have low rates now, but their rates now are quite a bit higher than they were then. They might have gone from.
We've just decided to make spitting on the street, a criminal offense. There was our patron Mike. I saw something that he posted on Twitter. He was like, this doesn't even make any sense. That it's probably in Florida that he was talking about a bill. They're going to make it a violent crime to flee the police or burgle an unoccupied home. Those are now going to be violent crimes. I can't see how you make either of those violent crimes, but that's what's being proposed in the House.
Well, but see, that's subject to an enhancement of sentencing. And,
uh-huh.
And there's nobody there on our side saying, wait a minute, ladies and gentlemen, Where is the violence in burglary? Now, if they actually engage in violence in the burglary, yes. If they take someone and beat them with a crowbar, that's violence.
Right. So you already have something that is illegal. So now you're making something that – I'm not saying people should go rob people's houses because it's not a violent crime. Nobody wants their shit taken. But I'm just saying that it is not violent when someone is not there. Obviously, if they were there, that would be a different situation. So how do you make an unoccupied property a violent crime?
Well, I don't know. That would be a question for them. You know, that's one of the big things. I'm about not calling something violent. It's not violent. And if there's no violence, it's a disservice to people. To me, we're minimizing violence, people that actually suffer from violence. By calling something violent, it isn't.
That's fair.
I were a victim of a violent crime, I would be angry. I'd say, what in the heck do you mean? You're calling that violent? I had staples put in my head, and I have trauma, and I have loss of motion on my left side, and I went through violence, and you're calling this violence?
Right.
What the hell's wrong with you?
Right. I see where you're going with that. That's an interesting way to word it.
So, but like I said, subjects to a tougher sentence, and that's why they want to do it. They want to hand out more punishment, and that's what the people in Florida apparently want.
Yeah, and so it comes back to we the people. We are the ones that are doing it to ourselves, and therefore, if we then take ownership of it, the part about this that I like is then we can take ownership of fixing it.
And that's what this podcast is about.
Absolutely.
When we reach 30 million listeners, and we're almost there. We're at 27.5, right? Now, right?
Yes, sure. It's up there.
Well, we are growing.
It is that. Could always use more, which always comes back to like this guy that I met that he can't use the internet. All right. How are we supposed to reach people that can't be reached? I'm still struggling with this one.
Well, I don't know. I don't. If you can't use the internet, the podcast model seems to break down, doesn't it?
It kind of does. But you have said that making an outright prohibition on the internet is problematic, and I'm with you, except that we have people that can't use the internet, or they're told to, and they're in that condition until they challenge it, and our people don't often have resources to go challenge it, and you end up in this whole catch-22 loop. I still wonder why a person can't get a device that they can go to their mom's house and plug in and download things like a podcast, and then just have that device. You're not using the internet. You handed it to your mom. You don't know what she did with it. Now you have a new podcast to listen to. That's what I would do.
Well, either that or I would contact one of these conservative foundations who claim they believe so much in the Constitution, like the Federalist Society, or go on and on. But Google conservative think tanks and say, why aren't you helping us assert our rights under the Constitution to have access to platforms of communication where we can petition the government for redress of our grievances?
Oh, that's interesting.
I'd be a little tongue-in-cheek here. I'd be a little tongue-in-cheek here because there are very few conservative causes that actually support what we do.
Right, but if you approach it just straight up from a constitutional point of view and a First Amendment, wouldn't they all jump on board, the ACLU included?
Well, the ACLU is a bunch of liberal dudes.
I know,
but what I don't understand is why conservatives don't apply more pressure to conservative advocacy causes and say, if you are what you claim you are, if you are the guardian of the Constitution, why don't you guard my constitutional rights? Why do they always turn to the liberal cause like the ACLU? I've always wondered that because. Of all of our podcast listeners, probably three of them are members of the ACLU. Most of them detest everything the ACLU stands for. But okay, that's fine. Detest the ACLU, but put pressure on the organizations that you believe in to support the Constitution that they claim that they support.
Right. Very interesting.
Now we just lost another 1,000.
I know, really. Yeah, we're going to be at zero. Hey, if we can reach zero by the end of this show, consider this successful.
Well, this is supposed to be thought engaging, and someone can leave a message or an email and challenge me on that. If I'm wrong, if there's a bunch of conservative causes that are protecting our speech and our rights, please call me out on it, and we'll get it on the air because I'm just not aware of it. I'm aware of everybody bashing the ACLU, and I always remind them, well, are you a member? Well, no, I hate them. Okay, so they're destroying the country. They're putting gays in the Boy Scouts, and they're promoting gay marriage, and they're trying to get due process for people at Guantanamo, and they're taking down the barriers on the bathrooms, and they're doing all these things, and they're taking God off the, and you hate them, but then why are you calling on them to save you?
Right.
And no one has ever answered that. So if somebody has answered that, please leave that one so we can play it next week.
All right. And then moving on before this podcast turns into 7 hours. From the crime report, why can't we rein in police misconduct, blame prohibition? Pretty neat little article that blames the excessive use of force of police that we are definitely experiencing at this point. But they were talking about some pretty horrific things that, man, you would end up just in detention somewhere and they're beating the crap out of you. But blame basically what Elliot Ness and Al Capone in that time frame back then.
Well, that I don't want to spend a lot of time on it because police misconduct is something that I rant about all the time, because I think that's a part of our problem is that we have overzealous enforcement. But prohibition brought on a lot of lawlessness as far as the average population was concerned, with Al Capone and all the gangs and things that the violence that, and the police basically were given carte blanche to do what was to keep us safe. Kind of what we've done full circle since 9/11. We've said we'll give law enforcement the powers to do whatever they need to do to keep us safe. Well, that's kind of where we were in the 1930s, as the cops were given. My point of putting this in here is perhaps maybe we didn't learn from our mistake of giving cops unbridled power back in the 30s, that there were a lot of bad cops, that there was there were misconduct was, and I think this guy was from Duquesne University, if that's how they pronounce it, this professor that did this study, and he drew the correlation. So we're just reporting on this on the study that was done by. It's Professor Wesley Oliver of Duquesne University School of Law, and it's worth noting that prohibition could be the origin of the mistakes that we're making again today in terms of turning a blind eye to everything that the cops do because we want to feel safe.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Well, then this from the Houston Chronicle. Federal judges butt heads with U.S. lawmakers over legality of ankle monitors for nonviolent suspects. Well, we have covered at least something along these lines of putting people that are pre-trial or even just, check kiting. All right. So you get a nonviolent offense, something pretty low end. Oh, now you got to do an ankle monitor. And there was something really recently in the last couple of weeks that said that, nope, they're not unconstitutional. You got to wear that thing for the next 30 years or something. And it's pretty horrific to have this little gizmo that probably even has like a moisture sensor on it to make sure that's still attached to your body. So now you'll end up with like itching around it and sweaty. And obviously it's a very fashionable thing to be wearing around town, right?
Oh yes. I can't wait to get mine. This is an article about a federal judge. I think it came from the Houston Chronicle.
It did.
Yeah. The Houston Chronicle. We had Bail Reform Act of 1984 at the federal level, and the Bail Reform Act basically did away with monetary bail in the federal system, which states are moving towards. And the presumption was that a person should be released with appropriate conditions that a judge would set, and then if they did pretrial custody, if no set of circumstances conditions could be fashioned that would reasonably assure the safety of the community and the participation at trial and blah, 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 that the person could be detained. without bond. And the what this judge is saying is that Judge Lynn Hughes, and I'm not sure the gender of the Lynn Hughes, but Judge Lynn Hughes, U.S. District Judge, has said that I'm going to order you to remove that because it's not something that I feel is appropriate. And I am the one, according to the Bail Reform Act, that sets the conditions of release. And Congress decided to circumvent that. And they put a condition in the Adam Walsh Act that required people accused of certain sex crimes as a condition of pre-release that they must be fitted with electronic monitoring. So you've got judges, including Judge Lynn Hughes, they're revolting, saying that I'm not going to do it because that you have shown me no evidence that this person poses any threat to a real child. It was a CP charge, a child porn charge. And so the judge refused and, in fact, ordered the opposite, it be removed. And it's got the U.S. Attorney's Office in a little tizzy about it.
Well, just for clarity, he was chatting online with a real person, but the person was, they say it was a teenage girl in the Philippines. I would even question, how do you end up committing a crime? I mean, how is that considered a crime when you're talking with someone in another country?
Well, I guess theoretically you could travel. I mean, not knowing the specifics of what the accusation was, whether there was any enticement to travel or not, but the broader issue is the judges feel like that the Congress have overstepped their bounds by requiring a condition of release that's not individually tailored. And we pay all this lip service to how we want things to be individually tailored, but yet the whole Sentencing Reform Act, these things at the federal level largely happened under Reagan in the 80s, the Bail Reform Act and the Sentencing Reform Act, where they did away with parole and they put in the sentencing guidelines and basically sent everybody to prison, where only about 5% of the people in the federal system get probation now, where usually prior to sentencing reform of 1984, about 50%+ of people got probated sentences. But these are people who claim that they believe of individual determinations, except for when individual determinations are being made, and then they don't agree with them. And that's how we got sentencing reform, because Congress got upset that we had disparities in sentencing. You had judges in San Francisco that were giving people probation, and you had judges in Alabama in the federal system who were imposing 12 years for the same offense. And they said, by golly, this just isn't fair. How in hell is it that we can have such a disparity when we have the same U.S. code across the country, and it's the same crime in California as it is in Alabama, but yet these liberal do-good judges are not sending people to prison? We can't have that. And that's how we ended up with the sentencing reform that we got in 84. And this is a backlash by a judge in particular saying, this is my decision, not Congress's, and I will decide if this person has to have this electronic monitoring, and I'm deciding that they don't have to have it.
Very good. So chalk it up for, I guess, our team on that one.
All right. I think one of our supporters said that there's more to it than that, but I didn't really follow his logic, so I'm going to have to look into that more. I think that he said it was a revolt because of the victims' advocates. So did you remember seeing that?
Are you talking about from HF?
Hank, yeah.
Yeah, no, yeah. I didn't pay attention to it at the time.
Yeah, but I think it's a general revolt of some federal judges being tired of told by Congress, I'm supposed to be a judge, not you.
Right.
And if you wanted to be a judge, you should have sought that office rather than Congress. So it's a revolt against their hands being tied.
Which would lead us to three co-equal branches, right?
Right.
All right. Well, this next one is a news clip from WFMY. So they call themselves My Two News about voters.
My Two.
Yeah.
Wow.
How about that? My Two. Not to be confused with Me Too, right? And so here's a little audio clip.
All right, now to some fact or fiction when it comes to voting and sex offenders. A teacher reached out to Two Wants to Know after she found out her school was a polling place. She wanted to know, is this a loophole for registered sex offenders to get on school property? And the answer is, well, it's a fact. They can be on school property. Two Wants to Know found out voting is an exception to the rule in North Carolina. Take a look at the law. It says if a registered sex offender's assigned voting precinct is at a school, well, then yes, they can still vote there, but they are required to notify the school's principal first. That's right. The registered sex offender, the responsibility is on them.
Well, I mean, I guess that's good news on one side, but like the way it's presented is this a loophole? I can totally see the lawmakers sitting up there going, haha, we need to come up with a covert way that the sex offenders can get on school property so they can abduct all the kids in the school. Come on, seriously?
I'm not aware of any
give me a break.
Any person of election day, any documentation. And there again, if it's out there, I'm just not aware of it, of any incident related to a voter on school property. This is a solution in search of a problem.
Right.
And here I got to bash capitalism a little bit. This is what news organizations have to do. They have to have ratings in a capitalist system. Program directors, news directors, and station general managers live and die by rating. And if people don't watch,
yeah,
they don't have jobs.
Certainly.
And it's just that simple.
I know, but and then you know, probably 30 episodes ago, I can't believe we're on 41, by the way. Congrats, Larry, on 41 episodes of this. How do you then create a model where you take away the drive, the incessant drive to make something that is, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, I guess is the expression. How do you take away that from their incentive structure? And I only come up with one answer, but, you know, I mean, it's one way.
Well, the answer is very simple. Turn the damn dial off.
Well, yeah, of course.
Ratings. That's the answer.
But that,
calling the station and saying, we repudiate this. This is crazy reporting. But that's the only answer other than government intervention.
Now, you wouldn't want
the government to regulate what they can and cannot consider news. I mean, that should be left to the hands of the private sector who does everything perfectly, right?
Well, I was going to go to the NPR model that is a very small fraction is publicly funded, but they aren't their funding structure is like a year either pre or post. I forget which way it's where they get their money, but it's completely outside of the election cycle. It's completely outside of the advertising structure. So and they don't do this whole screaming thing. It's very strange and very, I don't know. It's just a higher brain model of news, in my opinion.
Well, in mine as well, but we don't live in a capitalist system.
Sure.
And for all Americans, which we have a lot of good things about America, we have things that are not perfect that could be improved upon. Our delivery of news could be improved upon. And this is an example of the capitalist system does not serve us as well as possibly another system might, because like I say, program managers, station general managers, news directors, they live and die by ratings.
Right.
The stockholders that own these conglomerates who control the media is big business.
Yep.
This is not your locally family-owned television station.
No, it, not anymore.
It's a part of a media empire. And they live and die by ratings. And they have learned that when they run this stuff, the viewership skyrockets.
Yeah. Right.
And
of course
that's
it does.
Why they do it. And the only way you would stop it would be that the viewership would not skyrocket, or the big old bad government would tell them not to do it. And we certainly don't have any support for the big old bad government telling them how to run their news operation. So that's never going to happen.
Right. And it tickles our dopamine things to like, oh my God, there's going to be sex offenders at the school. And now you're like running around going, I wonder if that's one of the ones over there. I think then I also saw maybe today that Cuomo in New York, who there's like a partial pardon so people can get back to voting. They, the registrants have to vote after 7 p.m. if I'm not mistaken.
That's when the polls close in most states.
Fair. So yeah. So now like if you happen to be, you know, you're running late from work or whatever, and you're there at the 7 o'clock hour, you have a fairly good chance of running into a registrant, which is interesting. So maybe, yeah, I don't know. What do they hold them open for 30 more minutes? So all of them, the registrants can pack in there and get their voting done real quick. It's garbage. It's garbage.
Well, what is it? My2 TV?
That is,
people live in that service area ought to repudiate. They're not going to, but that's what they ought to do. They ought to say,
you know, we get a lot of articles out of North Carolina, and this is also North Carolina. There's a lot of SO news that comes out of that state. Well, then let's move on to a Reason article that is, should a math professor be fired because of a sex offense against children 26 years before? I know your answer is gonna be like, nope. He should not be fired.
Well, I don't know if that's going to be my answer at all.
I mean, if he's passed his sentence, why should he be fired? And I want to say he is – so he's in the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education, petitions for the review of a July 3rd award of an arbitrator that determined that – blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so that they were going to fire a math professor because he had some criminal offense a long time ago.
That is correct, but it gets a little more complicated here because he didn't falsify his application.
So he told them that he had done it.
Oh no, they asked him about a 10-year period that had expired.
Oh, all right.
So he was truthful on his application. He had done a crime that would be considered somewhat deviant, and he was an adult, and the allegation was on an 8-year-old boy, and he had served his prison sentence, and he had been successful, but it had been more than the 10 years that they asked on the application. But then they come to find out that he has the conviction, and then they say, well, we can't have that because we have minors when the dual, what do they call that, dual credit program where high school students can be in college. They said, we can't have that around here. And that would interfere with his ability to do his job, and he filed a grievance, and he ended up in binding arbitration. And binding arbitration, can you venture a guess why they call it binding?
No, I'm really struggling. I was reading that in the titles and so forth, and I was like, I don't even understand how this applies.
Well, but what does the term binding mean?
Well, in my opinion, it means that you get tied up.
Okay, so if we have if a dispute, if the professional baseball umpires are having a dispute with baseball management, and they agree to go into binding arbitration to resolve the dispute, and the arbitrator rules, what would you think that the that
oh well
the
then that means that their opinion stands.
Right. Well, that's what happened here. This was decided in binding arbitration.
Something like permanent. They're the final authority.
But the Commonwealth did not like the decision. So therefore, they felt that they should not abide by binding arbitration.
Right.
So they appealed and asked the court.
So you and I agree to have a moderator to help us resolve an issue. And then when that person makes the decision, I say, hang on, I don't like that answer. So I'm going to go above their head.
That is what happened here. And there are situations where an arbitrator can be set aside, but it has to be an egregious situation. I mean, they had to have been drunk on the job or something that would be egregious. But in terms of disagreeing with their decision, that is not enough. So the court said, sorry, you lose. This was binding arbitration, and that's what the term binding means.
Right.
So the arbitrator ruling in favor of the grievant, which was the instructor, said he gets to keep his job.
Fair.
So if I'm the Commonwealth, what I would do, now I would not do this personally, but I'm saying if I were the Commonwealth, this is what I would do.
Mm-hmm.
I would make his job almost non-existent, kind of like the Atlanta Police Department did when they wanted to get rid of Chief Inman back in the 70s when they said, okay, we can't fire you. The court says we can't fire you. They said, okay, you're right. You get to keep your job as police chief. Then they hired a super police chief called the Commissioner of Public Safety. And they said, Chief Inman, you can come to work if you choose to. You really don't have any responsibilities. All the command structure reports to the Commissioner of Public Safety, and you can read the newspaper. Well, that's what I would do to this guy. I would say, you know, since we can't fire you, what we can do is we can give you an office and you can hang out here. You need to be here between business hours and you have absolutely no responsibilities. And when you get tired at the end of the day, and when your time that you would expect to be instructing ends, you can go home.
Right. Yeah. You're not going to have any classes that you're teaching.
and based on the Inman model, I would say after a period of time that he would probably decide if you're truly wanting to teach, he might move on. But then again, since he has a conviction, he might not,
right?
Because he might like collecting the paycheck for not doing anything.
Absolutely.
And then you'd have to figure out a way to run him off by making sure he can't entertain himself. You might have to take his because in a classroom, I guess you wouldn't let him stay on their cell phone and on the internet all day. So you might have to continue to tighten the screws to But you would set about a way to get him to leave on his own volition. Is what
right.
you would do.
Right.
With them. but yep, that's what happened.
Yeah, that's interesting. Oh, so binding arbitration. So they had agreed upon a person to help resolve their issue, expecting it to come out in their favor. It didn't. So then they didn't like it.
Yep.
Way to play fair. Happened. Way to play fair ball. And finally, and then before we go into a touchy subject, I'll call it. So from Psychology Today is victims of sexual abuse face a lifetime of costly problems. The reason, the whole reason I wanted to bring this up is from one little paragraph in there, and it says, what can we do to address child sex abuse more effectively and more efficiently? To start, we can stop spending money on policies that just don't work, like sex offender registration. Numerous studies document the failure of sex offender registration and notification policies to improve public safety. Just, you know, find it kind of ironic that the article that was published that said Frightening and High, that this is, I'm pretty sure that this is the magazine that said, that's where this is coming from.
Mm-hmm. Well, it looks like this was posted May 30th.
Yeah. So just a month and a half ago. But, we were talking previously about how can we work better at prevention. You say it's not a winning argument. And not necessarily disagreeing with you, but if any of you went off and listened to that Emily Horowitz podcast where the interview, she was like, "Hey, look, if I don't want my girl," this is what Emily was saying. She has three girls. She was saying that I don't want my girls to end up in a position where they feel coerced, they feel enticed, like they can stand up and make their own decision if they want to about where they are going. Oftentimes victims are asked, well, why did you go to the person's room? And they're like, I don't know, I just kind of froze. Well, having the wherewithal to be in your own state of mind, to not end up in a compromising position. I don't want to sound victim blaming, and that might sound like that, but she wants to have her children educated and able to make appropriate decisions.
Well, I would want to clarify that I do believe in prevention, and I do believe that prevention works, and we see evidence that it works. I think we talked about it in the pre-show about the burglaries of homes. The burglary rate has largely dropped in most places because of advances in technology and prevention models. And I believe sex offense prevention can work. Got to be careful, though, because if prevention is merely encouraging people to report more, because there is a generalized agreement on underreporting, if you simply have more reports, you'll just be bringing more people into the system, and that's not really prevention directly. I mean, theoretically, it could be prevention if you brought the person into the system and the intervention from the system stopped a pattern of abuse that was happening, there would be some preventive effect from that. But be careful in prevention. But what I'm saying is it doesn't work is that no one has ever convinced me that we can have 100% prevention. We haven't had 100% eradication of any crime that I'm aware of.
No, certainly not.
Which means we're going to have sexual offenses. And the rate has already dropped quite a bit on what's reported. Maybe the underreporting has increased. I don't know, but the rate of reported sex offenses has dropped anyway. But we're going to have sex offenses, and there are going to be offenders who have to be dealt with. And going to the lawmakers who primarily deal with the after effects of crime, that's the easiest thing to deal with as far as they're concerned. My job is to protect my constituents, and prevention is difficult to measure. So you go in there and say, give me $1 billion and there's everybody else is also on that same billion, but give me $1 billion and I'll do great things for prevention. And you've got victims coming in saying, give me $1 billion so we can lock people up. Who's going to get the billion?
Right.
And so when I say it's not a winning hand, it's not a political winning hand when you go in and say, I would like you to divert limited resources to something that we cannot see as clearly, which crimes that don't happen are more difficult to quantify, versus trying to deal with people who have committed crimes where there's a demand for their scalp that something be done to them and that they be made to suffer more for a longer period of time, it's easier to appropriate the money to lock that person up than it is to appropriate money to prevent that person, because you're not going to prevent all of the people from committing sex crimes. And that's why I say it's not a winning hand. But it is a rational argument to be in favor of trying to prevent more victims, and I'm for that. But it just doesn't win in the setting that people want to use it to say, let's just go redirect our funding. The sex offender registry may not work.
Yeah.
There's no evidence that it does. But the money that's going to the sex offender registry is going to be very difficult to divert to prevention.
Interesting. Well, so yeah, and I wanted to highlight because it from the victim side of that's what this article is about, and then to have that information in there in favor of us having less registration stuff, I thought it was something good for us to have in there.
Well, I wonder how much law enforcement support you would get if you, since most of the states employ the law enforcement apparatus to monitor the registry. I wonder if you went to law enforcement, who obviously would claim that they want fewer victims. I wonder if you went to them and said, I'd like you to join up with us because we don't think the registry is doing much public good, and we'd like to divert this money that we're spending on paying your officers to go out and chase after sex offenders into prevention programs. Would you come to the Capitol and lobby for that? go make that argument. Come back and tell me how well it works out for you.
Right. Well, we did receive an email message from a woman who was writing on behalf of her son and was asking for assistance in helping him deal with his particular situation. And while I like the brainchild here, the idea behind this whole podcast was to help as many of us as we possibly can. But, you know, and I completely love having the voicemail messages come in, and I want to continue to answer those. The broader issue is that your situation is not unique. Mike in Florida, who's been on the registry forever, there are other people that have been on it for possibly longer or, you know, roughly the same amount of time. And in him getting relief off the registry could very well help the next person. So what I'm trying to say is that it's not about you, but how can we help each other? And I don't want to single anybody out as being like, hey, you're like our case study of how we're going to try and move this forward. There are 800, whatever number, 1,000 of us on the registry, and we're all trying to get relief, and we all live in crappy situations. But we here aren't able to just help you with your case, and we're not even lawyers to begin with. But I don't know. I just wanted to address that as being like the topic of the night. It's not to say, hey, don't write in and ask us questions and so forth, but just bear that in mind that it is, I guess it's our prerogative of what we are trying to do, but also like zoom out a level or two and look at this from a point of view of, well, hey, yeah, this helps me, but how can we help somebody else or more of us along the way?
I think you put that very eloquently too often a person thinks that their case is being unique, and of course it is unique to you. You're only one of many thousands and thousands who have very similar stories that are very horrible and tragic in terms of how the system has over penalized and over the top. And it's a struggle for the people to realize that they have been a part of this problem. You and I have been a part of this problem. All of us have been a part of this problem because it's an us against them. And when we were on the other side, when it was us, we were against them, the bad guys.
Right.
And we have been more than willing to vote for bad policies because they made us feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard for us as an individual to accept that we've been a part of the problem. That's a tough pill for most to swallow, that they've been a part of. It's a lot easier to think that my case was so egregious that if you only knew what happened to me, that you would understand how bad. Well, we do understand. Trust us. There's not a story that I think we could hear that we haven't heard before many times over about how unique your case is to you. But we've heard the similar story so many times. And what we're trying to do here is to mobilize. We're trying to mobilize people to be financial contributors to organizations that are trying to do reform, to be better educated voters so that they ask tough questions at candidate forums and say, I'm not going to support you if you continue to spread this type of rhetoric. Well, we're trying to have impact. And impact is one person can be the focus point of a case, what we call impact litigation. Yes, we do have to have a vehicle to ride to have impact, but we're not really on this podcast. We're not really in the impact litigation business per se. We're in the broader picture of trying to have impact on public policy. We're trying to help you to understand how public policy is formulated and what you can do to push back to have more impact. But trying to unravel an individual cases, like, I do what I can. There's only one of me here, and I do what I can to respond to as many people as I can, but I can't respond to everybody, and I can't offer everybody a solution to their problems, and I'm really sorry there's not enough people out there. And even if there were more people, there's not a solution to a lot of the problems that people have. This is overwhelming, what we're up against. It's overwhelming.
It is definitely a big machine that we are pushing back. But ultimately, to address, and I emailed the woman in question, her name's Diane, and this applies to anybody. She's asking for a mailing address to send in questions, and I don't have one. I don't have like a PO box. You know, this is just kind of a little shoestring little budget kind of thing. But as for anybody, if you have questions, you can email them or you could call. And that would be ideal, like, you know, formulate a question and ask the question, phone in and leave a voicemail message. Those are the ways that we are going to get there. And in the case of this individual, there are 40 episodes prior to this one that will answer a truckload of questions about anything that you would have that you're going to ask us. And hey, if your situation is that unique, by golly, it could be novel. You know, we had three questions tonight that you said were very well crafted questions that even caused you to kind of step back and go, I hadn't really thought about it that way. So, you know, we haven't heard it all, but we've heard, by God, most of it.
Well, what often happens is they want to tell the story. They know the story is critical, that once you hear the story, but the story is not that different. We've heard the story that's going to be told. The young teen who's only 20, just become 20 years old, that was dating someone for the last 3 years and had sex with someone who was below the age of consent in that state, and the prosecutor prosecuted them, got a felony. We've already heard that story.
Yeah.
We already know that the judge and the prosecutor went to law school together, and that they're in collusion as far as you're concerned, and that it's the most corrupt jurisdiction in the whole state of whatever state you're in. We've already heard all of that.
Right.
But the bottom line is, if you didn't have the law, like I've talked about the Anderson case that made the news of Zach Anderson.
Right.
And his father is so adamant that I've got it all wrong. The issue in the Anderson case, for those who haven't followed it, he was an adult and he traveled from Indiana to Michigan and had consensual sex with a person who was not old enough to give consent under Michigan law. And Michigan doesn't provide for any misrepresentation. And the girl had represented her age to be older than what she turned out to be. And that's what we call a strict liability offense. There are tens of thousands of young people across the land who have gotten caught in strict liability offense schemes where they've been forced to plead guilty because the legislature has removed the element of knowledge that the person was a certain age and that they were willfully engaging in criminality despite that knowledge. That is a constitutional defect. Well, Mr. Anderson was obsessed about his son getting railroaded, and he lost track of the bigger picture of strict liability is the real issue. Had there not been a strict liability offense in Michigan, his son would never have been charged, and he would never be going through all the horror that he's gone through. So I'm trying to look at the bigger picture, and that is unique to him as far as he's concerned, because it's his son, and he can't believe that a prosecutor who's so overworked and understaffed would have enough time to prosecute this case of two consensual teenagers having sex with all the serious crime. And it shakes him to the very core, because in all likelihood, I'm guessing he was probably for giving law enforcement all the resources they say they need. And now he has to take a step back and say, wow, maybe something went wrong here. And it's easy to think that it was a system failure that relates to his son. No, there's not a system failure that's related to his son individually. There's a system failure related to a lot of folks' son and daughters, but primarily son. It's usually boys who get caught up in this, because they're dating younger girls, because it's somewhat of a maturity imbalance. A guy's mature at a slower rate, and girls think it's pretty cool to date an older guy. So you end up with a lot of young men who are in this thing who have sexual offenses for having consensual romance. That's the issue. So I don't need to hear a story. And the point of that long diatribe was, I don't need to hear a story about how your son is on the registry because he's had consensual sex and she lied about her age. I've heard that 164 times already. But what I need for you to do is for you to understand that as a citizen of your state, you can put pressure on your lawmakers to change your statutory scheme so that there's not a strict liability offense scheme that we put mens rea into our offense, when particular seriously criminal offenses that are at the felony level, that there be mens rea, which is a knowing element, into the commission of a criminal act that's going to scar someone for life. That's what I need you to do, rather than looking for me for an answer. I need for you to look inward to yourself and to figure out how we can solve this big problem, rather than you just worried about your particular kid, because your kid is important to you, but the tens of thousands of kids are what's important to me.
And so then to summarize, change how we vote, challenge your politicians to push legislation that is in favor of us. And I think that's really all I wanted to, those are the main areas of focus.
So
cool.
I agree with you. And how do we make this podcast grow? What do we do from here?
That's a good question. Well, so at this point, we're on the Googles and we are on all the distribution networks. It is going to be on you people to share it with all the people that you know. That is, I don't know what else we can do, because I can't mail people I don't know their names of. And if they don't have internet, I don't know what to tell you. If you are in treatment class, tell them about it. If you have to know another registrant down the street or something like that, suggest that they listen to an episode or two. That's how we're going to make it grow.
And then we're going to utilize a giant advertising budget from the Koch brothers.
Yes. To
help. Can anybody help us get a grant from the Koch Foundation?
That would be pretty stellar.
Oh, is there such a foundation? I know that the Soros has a foundation, but what about the Koch brothers? They're on the conservative side.
I don't know, but can you imagine if they just had a rounding error, what that would do? They have so much money between the two of them, $20 billion a piece or something like that. They got big bucks.
Yeah, if we could get them to help us grow the podcast, because of course, being they're dedicated to the Constitution, they would want to preserve constitutional rights, right?
Yes, I heard an interview with him. He sounds whichever one I don't remember which one it is. An interview on Freakonomics, crazy rational sounding individual, very very much like right on top of things. I agreed with the things that he was saying. Absolutely.
Well, I think that on some criminal justice reform, they are actually on the right side.
I think so.
I was being tongue in cheek and also serious. Those of you who wine and dine with Cokes, tell them we need some help.
We do. We could definitely use it.
So, advertising, if we could figure out how to strategically place some advertising, might help us maybe in the prison legal news. I know that a lot of people are in prison reading the prison legal, but they actually have families on the outside.
Sure.
And there's a lot of people on the outside who read the prison legal news, but maybe that'd be something we can consider, but it's going to take more financial support. And Narsals does advertise, and they're not cheap to run an ad.
Is that right?
Yeah. It would be like a over $1,000 a year commitment if we're going to do like a 12-month contract.
Wow.
For a relatively small ad. Yeah. So you don't get in the prison legal news for less than $100-something an issue.
And it's also an expensive publication. And it's not a high production rag either.
Yeah, it's like 35,000, 4,000 copies goes out, maybe. But the the residual impact of that is you yourself can testify that a lot of people read a single copy of it. It doesn't just go to one person and get buried in their locker.
No, but God, that's a lot of money. But again, it's not even, you know, it's not a super duper high glossy mag or anything like that. It's almost like newspaper print.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Sure. All right. Well, then we have run long. This is right around an hour and 40 minutes.
Well, let's do it. So how do they contact us?
All right. Well, obviously the website, registrymatters.co. And we have the good old fashioned telephone that you love so much, Larry. It's 747-227-4477. Leave a message. You can text to that address if you want to. We can talk back and forth. If you want to shoot out an email message, you can go to registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And then finally, if you want to support, and that is by far the best way to support the podcast, and that is patreon.com/registrymatters. And one final thing is I just sent out a message to the people that are following us on Patreon asking if they would be interested in a live show. And we'll see what results from that. If people would like to kind of hang out in a chat room with us, and if they want to be brave and ask a voice question, you could
I'd love that. If people want to do it, we'll do it.
So if you're not a Patreon supporter, you should be able to go over there and vote on it. And then we'll try and set up something. And, you know, it's kind of still going to be informal. We're going to record at roughly a certain time, and you can hang out and listen to us banter back and forth as well.
And you can support us for as little as $1 a month.
Yep, that would be outstanding. I would so much prefer if, you know, the hundreds of people that are downloading it, that would just make me very happy to show that for you to show that you support the podcast that way.
It starts at $1, and it goes up from there to any level that you can afford and deem to be worth your while.
To infinity and beyond.
So, all right, Andy.
Have a good night, Larry. Enjoy it as always.
Thanks a lot.